Hello and welcome to season three of Our Dads Died.
We're back. My name's Rich.
My name's Tom.
And it's season three time. Tom, how have you been?
I've been great, my main man, my old son.
Dad?
My big boy. I've been fine. I've been dandy. I've had lots and lots happen to me in the interim last few months.
Yeah.
I have started work. I've got shifts as a duty editor, which is significant. So I've had a little bit of a potential promotion almost, which is lovely. I've covered the nominations for the video game BAFTAs. I'll be going along to the actual ceremony. Lots and lots of really cool things happening to me. What about yourself? What's going on in your life?
Nothing. Anyway, So episode one. No, there've been some changes. I've got older. I'm 34 now. I was 33 when this was going out before. Thank you, man. I have an agent. I've got signed.
You've got an agent?
Yeah, I've got an agent now.
Oh, we haven't talked about that.
I know, we haven't discussed this, have we? I know,
You've
got an agent.
You've been signed?
Been signed to Fab Comedy Management.
Why? what did they see?
It's a sort of...
Did you show them? You didn't show them your Edinburgh show?
No, it's like an outreach thing. They reach out to disadvantaged middle class white men in the comedy circuit, and they'll just try and raise them up a little bit, raise their profile.
Yeah, that's good. That's good of them.
Yeah. It's very kind. It's very kind, and it's bringing them absolutely nothing at all from their end. But I've got an agent, which is nice. And most excitingly, we've been, because we're talking now like we haven't spoken for months, but secretly, we're friends, so we do talk
on the DL.
But we've also
We WhatsApp.
We WhatsApp. Yeah, we live in different countries. So
I used to leave you answer phone messages. We shouldn't talk about that.
I think the goal was for you to leave me a voice note on WhatsApp that lasted a full 90 minutes. And that's how we discovered that the limit of voice notes is 30 minutes. And I think they assume that's got to be more than enough. If it's half an hour, then I mean it must be a mistake. But no, you managed a full 30.
Went the full 30. My voice was very dry by the end.
I can imagine. But
we're back, and the podcast is back, and we've been recording podcasts secretly.
We have.
So we've been banking them, is what we've been doing.
Yes, we've had some really, really good conversations with, to name but a few, with comedians, with therapists, with all sorts of fascinating people from the world of death.
Death jobs.
And speaking of, we're opening the series with exactly one of those.
With Evelyn Hollow, who is a parapsychologist. This is somebody who's... It's an actual, title. It's a proper thing. She's not a ghost hunter. It's an actual, real-life, respected career job, an academic.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a real expert on this subject. And I have to say, I went into it, I think, a skeptic would be the polite way of putting it.
Sure.
But, you know, talking to her... It's really, really interesting.
It is.
I would say that because I'm promoting my own podcast.
But it was a fascinating conversation. If you've listened to the podcast Uncanny, you'll be well aware of Evelyn's work, or on the TV show Uncanny. She's one of the experts that speaks to Danny Robbins and the rest of the team about real-life haunting cases and tries to approach them from a scientific point of view to work out what's going on. She's really interesting. She told us about her story, about her background, about her job. It's a great conversation. I was fairly into it. I'm a big fan of Uncanny, and I did what I quite often do when we get people on that I'm a big fan of, which is just sort of briefly crumble in their presence. but I think I held it together enough. She's fascinating. She's really interesting. She's very funny. She's a great guest. You should get her on your podcast if you've got one.
Yeah, and you can make that judgment for yourself now, as here's the episode. And enjoy the first episode of our new series, and indeed all our series, because we're back, baby!
We're back! Hello, this is Rich. I've got 10 seconds to tell you about some shows that are coming up. I've got two previews coming up in the next couple of weeks. March 21st at The Glitch in Waterloo and March 30th at the Comedy Cabin in Hoxton. So if you're in London, please check out my Instagram where there's links to buy all of those tickets, because I'd love to see you there. The show's about death, so you're going to absolutely love it. Anyway, back to the podcast. Thanks. I love you. Bye. What got you into your line of work? Was it something that you grew up with, or are you the literal black sheep of the family?
So for me, I think, you know, growing up, especially in Scotland, where I grew up my entire life, is a country incredibly, you know, steeped in kind of mythology and lore and storytelling and things like that. So it's not uncommon to grow up with ghost stories and the paranormal and folklore and things like that. And pretty much everybody, or almost everybody I knew growing up, had some sort of story or experience. I always had an interest in it, but it wasn't necessarily anything I wanted to do career-wise. When I was a kid, funnily enough, the first thing I ever wanted to be was a fighter pilot, which is a bit random.
Sure.
That's not probably what people would have guessed. And then I wanted to work for NASA, and then I wanted to be in forensic anthropology. So I took a keen interest in forensics, probably, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, 13, that sort of age. And so originally I thought about going to university for that, or for going to university to do writing. I've always been a writer. That's kind of foremost mm-hmm. what I do before I was a parapsychologist. And I ended up going to do psychology at Queen Margaret University. And originally I did I sort of specialised in forensic psychology. I took a job as a forensic psychology research assistant and things like that for many years. And it wasn't until I got to the fourth year of my undergrad that I found out that one of my supervising professors had a PhD in parapsychology. And I had no idea what that was. I'd never heard of parapsychology. And then when I started looking into it, I was like, I didn't even know you could study this as a field. So I sort of married that with, I was sub-specialising in interactions between human consciousness and quantum physics. And I'd been working at this for years and years, and all these sort of unsolved problems that we have in consciousness and in psychology. And then when I started looking at parapsychology and anomalous and unexplained phenomena, I realised that the two actually might work together, and that they might influence each other. So I decided to swap my speciality, and the head of the ethics committee said that it was career suicide.
nice. Real vote of confidence. Good.
Yeah, nice. He wasn't subtle with that at all. And then I did my master's in it as well. I did a master's in research and had the same parapsychologist supervise me. So I was able to continue to specialise in experiments in parapsychology. And then after that, I was a lecturer for 2 years at Queen Margaret, mostly teaching scientific methodology, statistical analysis, you know, sort of research methodology, things like that. You know, sort of guest lecturing on specialist subjects and writing. And then it wasn't until Danny Robbins emailed me saying, we're doing this show, it's about this historic poltergeist case, we need another parapsychologist for it, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, sure, sounds really interesting, incredible case. It's going to be for the BBC, and that turned out to be the Battersea Poltergeist.
It did fairly well, didn't it?
Yeah, it was number one podcast in the world for 2 months.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad.
Nobody knew how big it was going to be. I think it was the kind of timing with lockdown, so everyone was listening to podcasts and radio mm-hmm. and stuff. And it just went a bit mental. And then next thing, Joey, we were on This Morning and, you know, in every paper and magazine and stuff. And it was a bit overwhelming. And it hasn't really slowed down. If anything, it's only gotten busier.
That's incredible. So what's the day-to-day of a parapsychologist like?
So it depends entirely on what you do. There's parapsychologists that work in labs, obviously running analysis, experiments, things like that. You've also got people who work in academic bodies, so they'll be lecturers, specialists, consulting on things. And then the other side of it is that if you don't always work in an academic setting, then it could be, you know, research and sort of writing books, articles, things like that. And you can also be consulting on cases, whether that's historic or ongoing. tends not to be so much in that. It tends to be that people who go and investigate, reportedly haunted locations or whatever, tend to be kind of, sort of non-academic people who have an interest in investigating things using equipment or recording things.
Yeah.
It tends not to be the life of a parapsychologist to be. We're scientists and academics and researchers. We're not ghost hunters or anything, but
Yeah.
we are. We are sometimes asked to go in and be parts of teams. That look at things and analyze things. For me, I mostly work in television and radio now, so and writing. So I spend most of my time writing and recording or making, consulting on TV and radio shows, and writing books and things like that. So it's it's a slightly different career.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And do you get a lot of people who, because you said you're not like it's not ghost hunting, it's an academic field, but I imagine you would probably get quite a lot of emails or messages from people being like, it's quite cold when I go in the living room. Is that a ghost? Or my vase fell off the mantelpiece yesterday. I think I've got a poltergeist. Do you get a lot of those kind of.
Yeah, I mean, so my email inbox is always a mess.
Right.
I have the regrettable decision of having my email linked to my Instagram.
Yeah, I did
It's
think that
on
was
my
a bold
website.
move.
Yeah, I mean, it's on my website and stuff as well, but for sort of ease of, lots of people use social media to just look up people rather than Googling you and looking up your website. So I do leave it on my Instagram, but yeah, it is a choice. Yeah, I take a lot of emails. So I have a kind of blanket policy that I don't respond to non-business emails, because if I did, I would literally have to respond to all of them. Like, it wouldn't be fair to pick
Yeah.
and choose who I respond to. And it's mostly people just with sort of, who've had experiences who email me looking for guidance. And, generally my advice would always be, well, the uncanny, the show, Danny has his own email set up for it, where people can send stories and then researchers and Danny's team will contact them and speak to them. And I think that's really more where they're looking for them to go. But you do get people, yeah, emailing me some truly insane stuff. There's lots of really interesting historical experiences, but yeah, you do get some really bizarre stuff. And you get, yeah, the most backhanded emails from men who just, like, I get the most bizarre stuff. Americans who watch me on TV, who then go away and look me up on social media and then send me lots of messages every single time they watch an episode. And
Right.
men emailing me just the most, like, harrowing stuff. My favorite one that I got recently was a mathematician who was from England, who'd watched the Uncanny TV adaptation, and he'd emailed me basically saying that he'd seen me on the telly, he fancied me, blah blah blah. He'd looked up a bunch of stuff on my website, he'd gone through my social media, and then he was like, I've never had an interest in the paranormal, like, I am a logical, rational person and a scientist, so, like, I found it really interesting. And I'm like, I'm also a scientist, but okay. And just, yeah, really, like, backhanded, and then sent me some other thing at the bottom saying that, I don't know, somebody he was related to or something makes some sort of films or whatever, maybe contain, like, historical films or something, and that they wanted me to come down and star in one or something. And I was like, honestly, this is the most unhinged. Like, I can't imagine, you're a rational, logical mathematician, but you chose to look up a bird you saw on the telly, who is probably half your age, tell her that you fancied her, ask her if she wanted to pop down to Bath Spa or whatever, be in one of your cousin's films, and
Wow.
also that, she's not a real scientist. And I was like, doesn't seem that logical to me, mate, but okay.
I get the
When
feeling that if you went to Bath Spa, you wouldn't be returning from Bath Spa.
yeah,
That's the impression I get from that one.
yeah, he should be on a list somewhere, probably.
Yeah.
Almost certainly. Yeah. God, who'd have thought in the mathematics community they wouldn't be great at social skills or chatting up women? Bizarre.
I know, bizarre, unheard of.
Incredible news. And so your career, we like talking to people on this podcast who make their career from death, essentially.
Death adjacent, anything in the realms of death. That's the we love death jobs. That's our main thing.
And to what extent does it take over your life thinking about, because it's not death necessarily, it's sort of, I guess, the study of life after death, if or the science of of what those phenomena are. But just thinking about those things all the time take its toll at all?
I don't think so on me. So I have a habit of saying that death and I are old friends. I have never had a fear of death ever in my entire life. I don't know if that's because of the way that I've grown up or if it's because I'm a pagan. So like we don't really fear death, and there's no sort of all these sort of other religions that have sort of promises of afterlives and rewards and things like that. Like, we don't have that. We just simply believe that everything is a flat circle, and it's that we are part of it essentially. And you know, you sort of do your job and try to be mindful of other things and recognize that you are no more important than a weed growing by the side of the road, but it's important that you do exist, I suppose. So, you know, part of it is that, I guess. Also kind of proximity belief to, you know, working in the paranormal and things like that. You know, yeah, as you say, does it take a toll on you to have to think about death and things all the time? Or is it more comforting because you work with and in a field where death is not the end, where continuously people are having experience which would suggest that there is something else? So it's partly that, but I have a very strange relationship with death. And a huge chunk of my family are deceased. I have very little family left, and I've grown up in and around death my entire life. And growing up with, you know, various mental health disorders that I didn't even know they didn't get diagnosed until significantly later on when I myself was a psychologist. And I spent a good chunk of my life running into death's open arms head first. So I don't have have any sort of relationship with death at all, no more than anyone, you know, no more than a flower has a relationship to the sun, I suppose. I mean, you know, I don't see it as this abstract thing. It's just part of a system, essentially. It's a function of a system.
What a great way of putting it.
I have to say, I think I'm very afraid of death. I would I'd say I'm well scared of it. So this is quite interesting. Have you got any top tips just to sort of not be worried about dying?
Seriously, so Danny Robbins that I work with on lots of my shows is also absolutely terrified of death. like there was a point where for several years Danny, when he was younger in his early 20s, he had severe like panic attacks and, you know, kind of stopped hanging out with people and leaving the house because he was just so frightened of dying. It was really debilitating for him. And I wonder if that's why, you know, what pushed Danny into like working in the paranormal and things like that and sort of seeking for answers. I think the thing is that you have to let go. So the thing is that we are afraid to die because we don't want that to be over. We don't want it to be the end. We think we have more things to do. We want to be around people. We want to experience things. And especially if you have, you know, I think kids and things as well, it's probably much worse. I don't. But you have to let go. You have no control. And if you waste all of your time, like I'm a person obsessed with trying to control everything in my life to a debilitating disorder. I do not like not knowing things, and I do not like not having control. It gives me incredible anxiety. But the more you try to control it, the more it controls you. If you spend all of your time obsessing about when you're going to die, how you're going to die, what's going to happen when you die, then you actually cease to live, essentially, kind of like what happened with Danny. You become completely crippled by it. You have absolutely no control, and it doesn't matter, because there's either one of two things. Either you die and there's nothingness, in which case you will A, not know that you are dead, and B, you won't be able to do anything about it. So you will have no conscious knowledge, therefore it doesn't matter. And the other version would be that, okay, consciousness does go on after death. There is something, depending on what you believe in, there is something that goes on after death that might result in paranormality. There might be some sort of other side, there might be some sort of veil. And if that is true, then that's fine, because then you won't be dead. And what state you will be in or what experiences you will have is completely unknown, but in which case it's not the end. So it's impossible to tell somebody, don't worry about dying. It's like telling someone it's got cancer not to worry. Like, it's just, there's no way to tell somebody that, but it's the human ego. We think we are the highest point in the system. And if you look at things that don't have that sort of ego, and that includes other people as well, if you look at certain indigenous people and things like that, who don't have this fear of death because they have this collective social consciousness rather than this individual I, then they don't. They just see themselves as part of a system, and they're significantly less worried, and they have, you know, completely different rituals and ways of honouring death. And in paganism, we are much like that. You are simply part of everything else, and when you die, you will decay and feed something else. And then, so even if you don't go on, something else will go on. And it's very important that you play that role in the cycle. And if you try to control it, you are trying to control nature. And if there's one thing that nature does best, it is telling people, especially humans, that it does not give a fuck. It will. You can't control it. It's like firing a gun into a hurricane. Don't do it.
I think when I was younger, I just read the wrong books. Maybe, like, you know, I was given a lot of horrible histories books to read, which, you know, really lovely and fun and get you into that kind of stuff. But it seems that every time a ghost is mentioned in a horrible history book, that ghost is not having a good time. You know, it's gone wrong. They're having to wander a hall very unhappily. It's this sort of thing. So I think the sort of the folk tales of ghosts that I've become accustomed to are ones that are unhappy ghosts. Could you set that right in my head? Are there lots of tales of happy ghosts? Are we full of happy ghost stories, but they're just not as sexy as the sad ghost ones?
That's 100% it. There's an incredible amount of paranormal experiences and stories that are underreported or under disseminated because they're comforting. So, you know, thousands and thousands of people have experiences that they believe is like a deceased loved one making some sort of contact or just being present for a moment and things like that. But they'll probably only mention it to like their partner or maybe other family members or relatives, but it's not the sort of thing that ends up in a book or on a TV show or on a radio show. So we just don't hear about them. And the ones that you do hear about are the shocking poltergeist cases where houses are destroyed or where people are injured or die, because they are the most extreme cases. And that's why. But for every one of those, there's an equal, you know, comforting opposite. Absolutely. It's just that they're completely, you know, they are completely underreported, essentially.
Are there any cases of, like, reverse poltergeists where if they are happy, that instead of chucking stuff around, they start, like, putting things back, rehanging a mirror, straightening a portrait?
That's good.
Books back on the shelf? Any of that kind of business?
There are cases the opposite, like you say, where instead of rooms being destroyed or things being knocked off, things are put back. There's actually, I think there's at least, who was it I was reading about recently? Andrew Lloyd Webber, the famous playwright and musician composer. I was
not expecting his involvement today, but that's exciting.
So he,
I'm really in now. Now I'm like, oh, here we go.
Where is this going?
Andrew Lloyd Webber has there's a certain place, either I believe it's a recording studio that he must use or a concert hall, again and again, and they have a particular room, like a conference room or recording room or something, and they purposely don't set it up until 10 minutes before the people are due to arrive. And the reason that they don't do that is because if they do and they come out, things are moved and reorganized. And the same thing that if you leave, you know, lots of, you know, papers, sheet music and stuff everywhere, they'll come back and they'll all be organized in a neat stack and things like that.
Oh, wow.
We had a case on Cali, like season one, one of the first ones I worked on, where a girl in her bedroom watched, she was studying for like exams or something, and she watched all the folders that she had stacked up, like restack them, pull themselves out and restack themselves, or cassette tapes and stuff were completely reorganized. But there's quite a few cases where that does happen, which I don't know, is that more disconcerting or less disconcerting than a room being wrecked? Or like, what was the purpose of organizing the books? You know, does that feel less threatening?
Yeah, I guess so. It would be equally disconcerting, but I think there's something more sinister about a very neat ghost. It suggests a level of restraint and control that is more fearful than someone having a tantrum, I'd imagine.
That could also suggest a level of intelligence, because if you go in and in a room is just wrecked, it could be anything. It could simply be, you know, if we're talking about it in paranormal terms, it could be, you know, a burst of energy or some sort of chemical reaction or something happening, you know, at a molecular level in the room that creates some sort of interaction or reaction that creates the displacement for whatever reason. But if you come in and things are organized, laterally stacked up, organized perfectly, or organized in a neat row, or things like that, to have a level of cognition and intelligence in order to organize things by shape, color, weight, whatever. And so that, yeah, that to me is more interesting. But it's one of those ones that it's people think is less dramatic. And I'm like, yes, but anything could have knocked papers off of a table. But what is it that takes books out of a shelf and neatly stacks them by like color from the ground? Like, what on earth is that? That's not random. So that has to be something with some form of consciousness or some sort of cognition.
Certainly enough cognition that it's capable of judging you. You know, clearly, I mean, it's bad enough, isn't it? Being younger and having your mum judging you for having a messy room. Imagine coming in and a ghost has cleaned it up. Now poltergeists are judging you. I mean, that's enough, isn't it?
Yeah, it comes to something when a ghost is looking at your place and being like, you need to have a word with yourself here. This is out of order. I wouldn't mind it, though. You mentioned earlier that a lot of your family are dead, and that is very much what we look for in a guest on this podcast.
It's our main thing.
Yeah, that's the one. Non-negotiable
dead,
qualifying
dead, dead
factor.
Family, yes. Yeah. Straight away, dead. Someone dead important is number one. Yeah. Dead job, that's big on number two, though. That's fantastic, really... Yeah. We love dead job.
Yeah. But you have also... You lost your dad a few years ago.
I did. So that would be... God, do you like, since the pandemic, all the years are just 1 year?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I'm trying to remember what year that was. So this would be, this is 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And so last November was year two. So that would have been 2021.
Right.
Yeah, so I was in the middle of filming Spooked Scotland, as it's known in the UK, a TV show for the Discovery Channel. And luckily I was in Scotland and I was quite near to where my parents live, which is Livingston, where I grew up. And I got a bizarre, I was on set, but it was very early in the morning, and I got a bizarre text from my sister saying that my dad had had a stroke. Now, my dad had no... previous health conditions. He was a big guy. He was about 6 foot whatever, built like a brick shit house. He was a massive guy, former biker gang leader. And
really?
no prior health. Yeah, both
former
my parents
bike
were bikers.
Gang leader. That is
both
so
my
cool.
Were bikers.
It's a huge detail to just drop in, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll let you finish this, but then we will be coming back to the biker gang.
The old my dad's bigger than your dad, you know.
Yeah,
it's big, isn't it? Yeah.
So, but he had no prior health conditions or anything like that, and in fact, it had literally been his birthday the day beforehand. So, my father and my sister. My father was born 12th of November 1964, and my sister is 12th of November 1994. So, my sister was born on my dad's 30th birthday, much to his chagrin. So the previous day I texted both my sister and my dad to say happy birthday and stuff. I think I spoke to my sister on the phone, I can't remember. And my dad, I didn't, because my dad hates his birthday, you know, doesn't want to be made a fuss of. So I just texted him and I chatted to him for a little bit. And then the next morning I get a text from my sister saying like dad's had a stroke. So I call her. She's freaking out. I'm freaking out. I'm trying to get details on what the hell has happened. And she says that he went. So my sister was heavily pregnant at the time and was living with my parents. She was basically technically homeless. She was living with my parents. Parents, teeny tiny. We grew up in a 1.5 bedroom house. So my parents had a bedroom and Rachel and I were in a room pretty much the same size as this. So if you stood in the middle and did this, you touched both walls. And so that's the room that Rachel was staying in, and the bathroom is next door to it. And she says, dad got up, chapped on her door, basically said, was she getting up? She was like, yeah, I'll get up in a bit. And dad went in to have a shower. It's not even really a shower. It's a bathtub with a hose thing in it. And she said, it sounded like he slipped. he's quite a big guy. So she texted my mum, who was downstairs doing some emails, being like, dad's fallen in the shower. And mum texted back, saying, I don't hear any swearing, so he's probably fine. And then the next minute she said she heard this awful noise that she'll never be able to describe that sounded like zombie noises, essentially. Mm. And she instantly knew something was wrong. So my mum apparently also heard it. She came sprinting up the stairs. She shouted for my dad. And all they could hear was this morning. My mother kicked the door in. She took the hinges off with one kick.
Wow.
Kicked the bathroom door in. Don't mess with her. Kicked the bathroom door in. And they thought my dad had had a stroke because he was sort of slumped in the bathtub. You know, he was struggling to speak. You know, all the kind of hallmarks of a stroke, essentially. Mm. Struggling to speak, couldn't, you know, talk properly, couldn't lift his arm. So they called an ambulance. Luckily, they don't live far from a hospital. My dad was such a big guy, they couldn't get him out of the bathtub. They had like three ambulance crews and they were trying to work out, he's a really big guy, how to get him in the bathtub and then how to get him down a set of stairs and into the garden. So eventually they got him to the hospital. This was, you know, 2021, so still some COVID measures. So my mum and that weren't allowed to go to the hospital, but they said, listen, it looks like a stroke. Hopefully, obviously, it's fairly reversible, treatable, etc. And we'll give you a call when we've got more information. So that was what my sister told me. So obviously, I was a bit of a mess, but there was nothing I could, literally nothing I could do. There was no point in me going until we got more information. I wasn't going to be allowed at the hospital. So my director moved some stuff around so that we could finish my scenes quickly within an hour or so. And then hopefully we'd have more information and then I could just go. And about 5 minutes before we were due to be wrapped, I got a message from my sister saying, you need to come to the hospital right now. Dad's not going to make it. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Dad's had a stroke. What the fuck are you talking about? So I come outside and I can't remember if to this day if I spoke to my sister or my mum. But I know that when I did speak to my mum, she was incredibly calm. Just incredibly calm. And she basically said, it's not a stroke. What's happened is Dad's had some sort of massive brain bleed. You must have had a little bleed for a long time that we didn't know about, and it ruptured and it's destroyed half his brain. Like, Dad is gone, basically. He's brain dead. They've got him on life support at the moment, but as soon as they take it off, he will obviously eventually shut down. But Dad's not going to wake up. He needs to come to the hospital right now. I don't remember. Like, I started screaming. I know that my director virtually carried me down a flight of stairs. And the only thing I remember screaming is, what the fuck are we going to do? My sister was pregnant and my dad talked her into keeping the baby. I'm not having kids. I don't have kids. Dad was buzzing to be a grandfather. Rachel was seven or eight months pregnant. And I don't remember. And then we got to the hospital and they took him off life support. But because he was a big guy and he was physically otherwise healthy, it took him 4 days to die. Oh, so for four days... My sister, heavily pregnant sister, slept on the floor of a hospital room with my mum and I as we watched my father drown to death from the inside out. And then when he did finally die, I was the only one with him. Rachel and mum were asleep on the hospital floor. I was reading a book and I was reading a book and my father had terrible sleep apnea. So his breathing would sort of cut out sometimes anyway. So he did that. And I was so used to the sound of him drowning in his own fluids that after a while you sort of don't hear it. It's like white noise. So it took me a second to realise the noise had stopped. So I shut the book and was like, Dad. And then he suddenly made this noise. And I burst out laughing because I thought it was just like sleep apnea. And I was like, fuck you. I was like, you had me there. You know, like I burst out laughing. Mum and Rachel are asleep behind me on the floor. And then he didn't take another breath. And so I watched him die and I just stayed with him for the sort of 30, 40 seconds it takes you to actually to die. It takes about a minute for you to full sort of rest, die. And I'd spent years working in care, so I've dealt with lots of dead bodies, dead people. So I was fine. And it just made sure that someone was with him, obviously, when he went. And then I woke my mum and sister, obviously, and then we went through the kind of the procedure. But yeah, that was essentially what happened. He, you know, no prior warning, and you know, 1 minute he was there and then the next he was gone, and it was the morning after his birthday as well, which is fucking ridiculous. So but yeah, that's what happened.
My God. It's incredible when it's that. I mean, my dad was similar. It was very, very quick. No symptoms, just gone. How did you adjust afterwards? Were you in shock for a while? Did it take a while to sink in, or what was the sort of the immediate aftermath like?
I don't think I was necessarily in shock. I think I was initially, obviously, because I just, your body's in denial. You're so confused and you know, everything was fine 5 minutes ago. So I think there's that definitely initially. But by the time I got to the hospital, My mum is one of the most calm people you'll ever know in your life. So my mother did not cry. My mother was very practical. And my sister was in fucking bits, obviously. My sister was also heavily pregnant, and I can't imagine what that was like for her. We were in the hospital. She had an appointment, obviously, to check on the health of the baby whilst we in the same hospital whilst we were watching Dad die. So she had to walk from my father's death room to her appointment on the other side of the hospital and then walk back to my father's death room.
Wow.
So it was mostly just trying to function and just trying to sort stuff out. Once Dad died, I stayed at the house for a week, maybe 10 days to help organise the funeral. I helped sort my mum's like widow's pension and just sort of all the paperwork and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. My sister was sort of between the house and her baby daddy's house. Obviously people were coming to the house and stuff and focusing on, you know, and trying to get mum to eat something was a nightmare and things like that. So I was kind of just doing jobs, paperwork, cooking, trying to help with things because obviously everyone's focus is on trying to deal with mum and my sister because she was heavily pregnant. So I, you know, it was quite difficult though for a while because I think everybody kind of forgot that he was my dad too. I was just sort of, because I live in Edinburgh, they live in Livingston.
Yeah.
And things like that. And so I have a very, they all live near each other and stuff. So I think I sort of just became the help for a bit because people would come to the house and be obviously, how's your mum and how's your sister and talk about the baby and stuff. And I was just sort of the person taking coats and making cups of tea. So
it's starting to sound like you almost became the dad figure for a bit. Sort of looking after your sister and then looking after your mum.
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, once we got to sort of dealing with everything and then sort of after the funeral, I went, you know, back to Edinburgh. I lived by myself and my partner and I at the time had sort of separated. He'd moved up north and then we'd sort of started seeing each other again. And so he'd come down for the funeral and stuff and whatnot, which was good of him. And I went back to the flat and packed up some stuff and then I went up to stay with him for a couple of days up north where he worked just to try to let my brain process it. And then when I came, but then shortly at the end of that, I was hospitalised with chronic gastritis due to stress. And then so I spent the next month or so lying on the couch by myself in the flat I lived in, which was the basement of a church. So it's virtually windowless. It's pitch black. It's like living in a shipping container. And I was completely by myself. And I could hardly move. The pain was so bad I would black out in the bathroom and wake up from it. I couldn't eat anything. I couldn't do anything. I lost loads of weight. So that was fun. So I was dealing with the health issues and my father's death, and I was basically completely by myself in like a windowless flat, out shut away from everything. So it probably wasn't the healthiest way to have to have processed my father's death. I don't think I ever really have, to be honest. I've just compartmentalized it, and I just simply get on with things. But I will be doing something. It's been 2 years now, and I will just be doing something. Be like, fuck, my dad's dead, and just do you know what I mean? And then just be like, what the and then it would just like disappear again. Yeah. But I still get hit with that sometimes really badly. Yeah.
It's weird. It becomes so normal so quickly. Like I remember as soon as he was dead, it was like bang, yeah, I know he's dead. And of course he's dead. That makes sense. And then like you say, every now and again I sometimes have it with I'll just like read a book or hear a song or something and be like, oh, I should send that to my dad. Oh yeah, hang on. He's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, but I have that, yeah.
Going through the grieving process in chronic pain in the basement of a church in a windowless room, yeah, it doesn't sound like... I mean, it sounds sort of like exposure therapy in a way, just like really, really face it full on. But maybe not the easiest way to deal with it. Did you have a bit of time off work and stuff?
So I was already... So I was between split jobs at the time because I was filming TV shows, but I was also still working as a manager in a bar part-time. So when I wasn't away doing projects, I worked in the bar and I'd worked there for like 6 years. So I was supposed to finish filming and then go straight back to the bar. But because I had to come away in the middle of filming, I had to miss a week and a half of filming because there was the 4 or 5 days of watching Dad die and then sort of a week to 10 days of planning the funeral and the funeral. So I missed all of the rest of filming. So I had to miss that. And of course, because I work freelance, I don't get paid for it. So I lost a huge chunk of money, which also added a huge amount of stress that I didn't need at the time. And then because I got, and then immediately after the funeral, I got, within a couple of days after the funeral, I got hit with developing chronic gastritis. I tried to come back to work, but the I think Rob, who was my assistant manager at the time, was like, just take the week because like don't you're only going to make it worse, and you physically can't come to work. So I think I ended up with a week off before going back to work, which is the most amount of time I've ever had off for a death, because every other family death I've had, I had the day of the funeral off and that was it. Or when my grandfather died, I didn't even have the day of the funeral off. I came right from the funeral to the bar and worked a night shift, because you can't get time when you work in hospitality. There is no such thing as like time, like it's not unionized. So when someone dies, you have to kind of call and hope that they can cover your shift to get that day off. And then the funeral, you sort of hope to move stuff around. But I had so many people die within like 30 days of each other that by the time we got to the third funeral, I was like, work are going to think I'm taking the piss. Like they're not going to give me it off. So I just went to the funeral and my sister drove me from the funeral straight to work and I just clocked in and did my shift basically. So.
Sorry, how many, who died in the 30-day period?
So we had my paternal grandmother, so my dad's mum, Mrs.
The big
Hudson,
one.
who I was the big one, who I was very close to. I lived with my grandparents for 5 years or so,
Oh,
and
wow.
I was very close to my grandmother. She was her first family death, which is always the worst one as well. She'd had brain cancer for a year, so at least we were prepared for it, but obviously it's still the first one is always the worst one. So that absolutely destroyed our family. And the most my dad was dealing with that, 30 days later, my mum's mum suddenly died. She'd been completely fit and healthy her entire life. She was hospitalized with what we thought was like kind of like pneumonia or Lyme disease or something. And then she just went completely downhill. And it turned out from we found out much later from an autopsy and stuff, she had an incredibly rare also brain cancer. Completely different brain cancer, incredibly rare. So it came out of nowhere.
Jesus.
So she died. So of course, then my mum was really fucked up. And then 30 days after that, my mum's dad died. He fell and broke his hip.
Fucking
Fell and
hell.
broke his hip. Went to the same
Holy
hospital. Was
shit.
a floor above my grandma. They were divorced, and just never recovered. Died. So literally, my mum was made an orphan in 30 days from having both parents. And then 30 days after
Jesus
that,
Christ.
my fat family dog, who was like my dad's best friend, so he'd been illegally sacked from work like 10 years prior and just sort of did stuff around the house, and the dog was his like main companion. The dog was the son my father never had, and he had to be put down 30 days after that. So yeah, we lost all of my grandparents apart from one plus the dog in the space of like 2 to 3 months, and no one was ever right after it. Do you know what I mean? Like it just
No,
it fucking destroyed our family. There was no like that was it. Christmas was over. There are no Christmas is not a thing anymore. It was all around about Christmas time as well. So there's no more like family meals and things like that. Like we don't. The family was complete schism after that essentially.
Do you think having that kind—that's a rare experience, right? There's few people, certainly in the West, who've had that many deaths in such a short period of time and had to deal with them. Do you think that that had an impact on where you ended up going with your career? Do you think that that impacted it in any way, dealing with death and that kind of being so close to that much death all at once?
I think not, because prior to that I'd been around death that wasn't personal to me. So when I first started my bachelor's degree and I went to live with my grandparents, I worked in private psychiatric care and I dealt with death every day. Sometimes I got to work at 7 in the morning and had 3 dead bodies to clean before I had a cup of coffee. I probably had in the 3, maybe 3 and a half, 4 years I worked there, I probably had 35 deaths, maybe 40 deaths. And so I was incredibly used to death. I've done palliative care. I did palliative care for many patients. So I dealt with families, grieving processes, cleaning dead bodies, seeing them, discovering them, being there, watching them die. So none of that bothered me in any way. But I think I also didn't really have a choice because I couldn't have time off work. I couldn't afford, if you wanted time off work, even if I'd been able to beg for it off and somehow someone was able to give me it, I wouldn't have been paid for it. And I physically couldn't afford not to have worked. So I didn't. I lost a big chunk of my family, and I just had to. There was points when Mrs. Hudson, when my grandma was dying, where I was going to the house to help with her kind of palliative care at the house, and was going straight, was doing like teaching at university in the morning, lecturing, going to do her palliative care on the other side, complete other side of the city, and then coming to the bar to do like a 10-hour shift, and I still had like her blood down my shirt and stuff like that. Go home, sleep for 3 hours, get back up, do whatever, and I worked 80 to 100 hours a week in amongst all this, and so you don't really process anything because you don't have a choice. When you're working class, you don't have the privilege of being allowed to process death or have time off or like go to therapy or anything. It's you work or you starve. And having, I grew up lower working class, I'm now currently working class, I've gone up a half step in the world. you don't have the privilege of having a choice. I can't go home for 10 days. I can't have 2 weeks off to go and protest. It's okay, well, they're dead, they're in the ground, I have to go to work tomorrow, otherwise my electricity bill will not be paid. And that's it, unfortunately. That's the system, so.
Yeah.
And do you feel like you have processed that? I mean, like Tom said, that's such an intense period in such a short space of time. And then your dad, I guess, a few years later. Are those things that you still feel like you need to process, or are they... Is it time? Is it just getting used to the fact of what happened?
I think with the latter two, Carmen, who is my mum's mum, so my mum's parents, Carmen and Raph, with those two, I think I had less, I probably had less difficulty with, because even though I loved them, I wasn't as close to them as I was to other people. So those ones were obviously horrendously difficult on my mum, but maybe less so on me. And Mrs. Hudson's death destroyed our family. You know, she was probably the most loved and sort of the matriarch of the family. And I lived with her for 5 years. And I also often said that I felt like she was the only person that actually loved me in my family. And like, I don't doubt my parents. It's not to say my parents didn't love me, but a complicated upbringing. And I'm not close or wasn't close with, and my mum's still alive, not super close with anyone in my family. Other than, but when I went to live with my grandmother was the only person that showed me like unconditional love. Like if I had been a dinner lady, my grandmother would have been buzzing. She would have been like, "Are you happy?" And if I'd said yes, that was great. You know, if I'd won Best Dinner Lady of the Year award, she would have rung every person in her phone book and told them so. You know, she didn't care what I did, and she didn't. I'm an overachiever by nature, but she didn't care. Like, she was like, as long as, you know, you're happy and you're doing whatever, it didn't really matter. And that was apparent in everything that she did or ever said to me. And she was also one of the only people in my family who ever showed me any respect. When she asked for my opinion on things, even including her own care at the end, which was difficult for me to process. When she got diagnosed with cancer, so the first thing was that she'd collapse, and then they found a mass in her brain, and she didn't understand obviously terminology or anything. And I was the one that she asked about it. I came to the hospital and I looked through the chart notes, and I tried desperately not to make eye contact with her because I knew she was watching my face to see how bad it was. And it was about as it was stage four. It was about as bad as it could have been. And when she was getting lots of, you know, when they were offering her chemo and other things, I was the one that she texted about it and asked, you know, what do you think I should do? Like, what do you think the options are? Like, what is going to happen? And so to have loved me and respected me enough to ask my opinion on her own end of life care, then there isn't a higher mark of respect for me than that. So when she did die, I blamed myself for a long time because I was convinced. I just before she collapsed, about 6 months, well, maybe slightly more than that, maybe a year before she'd been taken to hospital, I'd moved out. And now stage four does not appear overnight. We reckon she had it for a long time, and she hid the symptoms because she looked after my grandfather, who's an interesting man, and who is quite disabled and has lots of things wrong with him. So she did all of his care and looked after him and stuff. So we reckon she just didn't tell anybody when she was having any of these symptoms because she wasn't allowed to complain. Her job was to cook, clean, do the medicine, and sort my grandfather out, basically. So we I reckoned had I not moved out, I would have clocked the symptoms, because I spent a lot of time with her, I watched her, I helped her with things. And had I not moved out, I would have saw the symptoms, which means I would have caught it early, because I, as a psychologist, I'm, you know, in medical training, I knew what I was looking for. And so I blamed myself for that. And then I also blamed myself because she got better and then she suddenly got worse and then she died. And I thought, you know, did I advise her on the wrong care? Could I have done something else? So that was incredibly difficult. And even though, like, I know now that that's not true and there's nothing we could have done, that was really hard for me to process for a long time. And her death certainly was the one that that ate away at me for the longest. I didn't process it at all. And I think I do now, but still not all the way. And it's kind of the same with Dad. Like, I know that Dad's dead, but also sometimes it's hard for me to remember that Dad was ever there in the first place, if that makes sense. Like, my brain is so used to him just being dead. He could have been dead for 100 years or 2 years. My brain can't tell the difference. It's just sort of compartmentalized. And it's like, I know he was a person, and it's not like I don't have all of the memories and stuff, but I can't remember the sensation of him being alive. It's like phantom limb, essentially.
If there's one thing that's helped me with the death guilt, which you're describing a pretty hardcore example of it, but nonetheless... the death guilt is a big thing, is reconciling that if the death guilt in my head wasn't, oh, you should have seen your dad more, you should have called him more, it would be something else. There would be always a way that my brain could come up with a way to make me feel guilty about it. You just have to go, brain, I don't listen. You stop that, because this is not what we're doing today. And listen to a different song. That's oh my god, I think so many people will hear that and go, yeah, death guilt, that's me, I've been there. But wow, that's a tricky one. That's a tricky one to tell your brain off for. A really tricky one.
I think it's, I mean, everybody has, you know, whether it's survivor's guilt or death guilt or different variations of it, and you'll always do that. I think it's, I mean, everybody has that. Yeah, you know, like you said, you know, did you call enough, or did you speak to them enough? Or, but then also, What is worse, knowing that you have this lengthy period of time in which you can talk to a person, say goodbye to them, have conversations, and you know, but have to slowly watch them obviously become a shell of their former self, depending on kind of what the affliction is? Or is it worse to just have it taken away from you? Because at least then you didn't have to spend years and years watching them lose themselves or be in pain, worst of all. But then also you were robbed of all the final, you know, robbed of all the final conversations. You know, me being robbed of a final conversation with my father is so frustrating, because you don't, there's so many, you don't get to ask anything. And so there's also not an aspect of guilt, but also an aspect of like anger in that, because there's probably so many things that you wanted to ask them. And my father being quite emotionally closed off, well, that's not true, I don't think. My father actually, I think internally, was a very emotional person, but just was unable to articulate himself. So he came off to, I think, a lot of people as being like an angry kind of emotionally closed off person. And that's actually not true. I actually think towards the end and later life, I realised that my father was the emotional person and my mother is actually the sort of, cold's the wrong word, but do you know what I mean? Sort of less emotional thing like that. But you just have different perceptions of your parents growing up. But you do feel robbed of lots of personal conversations and questions and things like that. But there's nothing you can do about that. And so, you know, like you said, like dwelling about that and thinking about that achieves nothing other than you'll just drive yourself insane.
It's the dichotomy you described. Which is better is the dichotomy at the heart of the podcast. My dad died of cancer over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Rich's dad died without him getting a chance to say anything. Let me tell you, the brain just gets you, though, because I had a chance to ask lots of questions that I didn't. And then my brain comes up with questions that I would have never asked him. I managed to convince myself, ask him favourite Liverpool player, ask him his favourite song, get these things done. Then after he died, my brain went, pretty soon after he died, he went, oh, you never got him to teach you how to make his favourite cocktail. So,
yeah,
got ya. Feel sad about that one now, which is just stupid, for goodness sake. But, you know, the brain does these things.
It's the finality of it, isn't it? That's the thing. It's all coming to terms with how final death is. It's everything that you ever think of, you can never do that again. And like you were saying, it's I have the same experience sometimes where I just think, isn't it? It feels really weird that I used to just have a dad, that he used to just be around. I could call him and text him and stuff. That seems like a really alien concept now. And you do take it for granted. And then it's impossible to not feel guilty for that later on. In your work, how much do you think grief is maybe a part of when people are seeing phenomena or experiencing things? Is grief often playing a role in that?
I think it definitely can. Grief is perhaps the worst of all human emotions. And when people are experiencing grief, either suddenly or over a long period of time, either or, obviously you're having negative effects on the brain, stress, not sleeping, you're probably not eating probably, chemical imbalances as well. And so that does, you know, that can definitely give rise to reported some paranormal phenomena. You're seeing things like the corner of your eye or mishearing things. You might also be likely to misattribute things. So having a certain experience or even a smell or a sound and then attributing it to the deceased person, because that is all your brain can think about at that time. So yeah, absolutely. And I think that there will be certainly a lot of cases where that is the case, where it's not paranormal, it's simply grief and you know, mental health and neurology and things like that. But to me, it's not my job to tell people that. My job is to rule things out. So all I can say to a person is that it could be this or it could be that. And I think that for some people, if they have an experience and they believe, you know, for instance, that that is their dad, then that's fine. And that's your dad. And it would be arrogant of me to come in and be like, well, it's not your dad. You're being you're being silly. You haven't slept or you haven't eaten or you're stressed or whatever. It's not my job. It's absolutely none of my business. If you have an experience and you feel like that's your dad, that's fine, sweetheart. It's your dad. Like, it's not my job to tell you otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's something that's bringing someone comfort, it would seem churlish to then come on with all your science and be like, no, actually, yeah, it's none of that. It's sleep paralysis, so get fucked.
With all your science? I'm armed with a degree!
I'm guessing the answer to this is no, but you've not had any experiences yourself since your dad died, that where you thought, oh, maybe any paranormal experiences or anything that have maybe brought you comfort or that have just been hard to explain?
My mum certainly has. My mum's had a lot of experiences throughout life. And shortly after my father died, just before my father died, he'd sold one of his motorbikes and he'd been given cash for it, and he did half the cash, I think, he put in the bank, or he did something with it, he bought something with it, and the other half he put somewhere in the house, somewhere safe. And then when dad died and we were trying to work out how we were going to pay for the funeral, my mum was trying to work out where this money was that was in the house, because it was about £1,000, and so she was trying to work out where this money was, and she could not find it. Like, the house is tiny. And we've lived there our entire lives. And my mother has been with my dad entire life. So she knows the house by the back of her hand. There's a handful of places it could be. And it wasn't anywhere. And it was driving her insane. And, you know, it takes, the pagan belief is that it takes a certain amount of time for the residual consciousness of the soul, or whatever you'd like to describe it as, to get to where it needs to be. And so it's often that we would light a large white pillar candle in the front-facing room of a house, in order for the person, when they get to the veil, or whatever you'd like to call it, to be drawn back to the house. Because that was where my mother wanted my father to be. As soon as she died, she said he will return to the house. Like, she just knew that instantly. That's what she knew to be true. So we'd done that. And so, you know, within sort of a week or so of the funeral, my mother would say, I'll know. Like, I'll know when he's back in the house. She didn't specify how. She just simply said, I'll know. And I believe that. So, and then one day she texts me and she says, you'll never believe what just happened. She said, I came home and I was standing in the living room. My dad, being a big guy, has got this monster armchair, this big sort of like lazy boy leather armchair thing he's had for a lifetime. And behind it is a unit, this sort of like display cabinet. And on the very top of the display cabinet is all photographs of our dead family members, because we have quite a lot of them. So there's, you know, one of my grandmas, so on and so forth. There's about eight of them, all different framed pictures of different deceased relatives. And after the funeral and stuff, my mum had sort of kept the funeral picture, the larger one is at the fireplace. Just before my father's death, the other thing that they were doing was they were sorting out sort of family photographs and things like that. And this one that my dad had managed to get fixed or restored or whatever, they'd had framed, and they'd added it to the deceased relatives at the top of the mantelpiece. And my mother came home, and she was standing, she was just her by herself. She came home and she said she was standing in the living room, she was standing at my father's chair with her hands on her hips, and she was like, David, what have you done with the bloody money? Because she was just at the end of her tether, and she heard this bang. And she thought, what the fuck was that? And she looked up, and one of the photo frames had fallen flat on its front. And so she got up on my father's chair. She went to write the photograph, and there behind the photograph was a stack of money. She just texted me and went, your dad's home. And I was like, yeah, that's it. So, that house is all my father knows, and so yeah, if there's anywhere he is at that house, and you can tell that like when you go there. I haven't been out to visit my parents' house for probably close to a year now, with a lot of filming and just other stuff that's been going on, but yeah, you can tell, like when I go to the house and I sit in the garden to smoke or whatever, like I just chat to my dad, I just talk to him out loud, because then you can tell that he's there, so that doesn't it doesn't really bother me. I don't necessarily see it as paranormal. The thing is, you have to, it depends, because I can, you know, you can answer these things as a parapsychologist, or I can answer them as Evelyn Hall, parapsychologist, or I can answer them as Evelyn Hall, pagan, because who I am as a person and who my job is sometimes don't match up, and that's fine. There are lots of eminent scientists who are also Christian or Jewish or Muslim, and that's fine. Those two things don't have to be at odds with each other, and it's sometimes detrimental to yourself to always be looking for like the scientific puritanical answer in everything. Then you simply forget to be a person who's just supposed to be having experiences. Not everything has to be analysed. And so if I go to a house where I feel my father's presence, or if I want to just talk to my dad, then I will, rather than me being like, you're being silly, this is unscientific, who gives a fuck, I'm not at work. And sometimes people also forget that I'm not my job, and that I am also a person with a dead dad.
Yeah. And it sounds like quite a useful ghost to have, if it's a ghost where you just go, is there any cash lying around? And he'll immediately identify it.
Yeah.
That's a good guy to know. Go room to room and just be like, is there a stack of notes in this room anywhere? It's very, very useful as a poltergeist.
I really like that one. I mean, I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Sometimes we get a little bit talking to someone. I definitely do the thing Rich does, where I can fall away. I just enjoy listening to them talk, and eventually sort of go, oh no, I'm not listening to the podcast now, I'm making it happen. I have to ask questions.
I'm an active participant.
I'm an active participant. But I think in amongst some of the things she was saying there, I really, really found interesting one of the things she was saying right by the end, about having to differentiate her own beliefs and who she is, believing in the paranormal, and her own beliefs of pagan, with what her job is, trying to find the reality and the truth behind these paranormal events.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting dichotomy.
And it was interesting hearing her, just having someone who has so much experience and so much like training and knows so much, to say, yeah, there are things that I don't understand and things that have happened to her, like the story that she told at the end.
Yeah.
Something that's happened to her that she's like, I'm not going to try and tell you what it is, but I can tell you that I can't explain it.
Yeah, and she says she believes the dad is at that house, is where he's returned to.
Yeah,
he's hanging around. She'll chat to him in the garden, you know. Awesome, and those things, they bring her comfort. Then that's great. I think, I'll be honest, if I went, I don't know, there wouldn't be a garden, but there's a balcony. If I went to my dad's flat, sat on the balcony, started chatting to him, I'd feel like a bit of a plonker. So I wouldn't be able to do that. But that's actually kind of sad, because it means I can't get comfort from doing that in the way that she can.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, who's losing out here?
Clearly, well,
one of us is.
And I think if I went to my dad's garden and started talking to him, the people who live there now would ask me to leave, which would be sad.
Yeah, they wouldn't be happy with it. What if you went there and started talking, but then you realized that I was there already and I was talking to your dad.
If you got there first, you started talking to my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've been really slagging him off.
Yeah, yeah. But then I came back and I was like, actually, he was really kind.
Imagine if I got there and he was like, I think of Tom as my favourite son now.
Yeah.
You'd formed a really close bond with my dad.
That'd be devastating for you, wouldn't it? But then you hadn't been talking to him, whereas I had, so of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And there'd be, I'm the only one who's been chatting to him for the last decade.
There'd be in-jokes that you two had that I wasn't a part of. And...
Oh, what a nightmare.
God, that would be horrible.
Would happen, inevitably.
Before we go any further, if you do want to follow up on any of Evelyn's work, evelynhollow.com. That's got everything on it, but the podcast Uncanny is on BBC iPlayer and the TV show Uncanny is on BBC iPlayer, and she is excellent and they are both excellent as well, so do check those out.
She also revealed that she checks her emails, so good email her. She did say she doesn't reply to them. I'm in a very similar situation. I do read all my emails. I don't reply to any of them. And I similarly have a very public-facing email address. So you can email me there. I won't reply to you. I will read it. Please don't. We have an email address on this show you can email where we will reply. And we will actually reply to you. It's ourdadsdied@gmail.com. Please do get in touch if you have any questions, if you have anything that you thought particularly interesting about the Evelyn Hollow episode.
Or if there's just anything you want to contribute to future episodes, then please.
Oh yeah, if you have
send
a thought, this would be a good topic.
Yeah.
We've got loads, but we'll add it to the list.
Yeah.
Absolutely. One thing we want to start doing going forward in these episodes, I've got a little feature idea we've got for you. And that idea is we would like to start talking about our dads of the week.
There's the jingle.
There's the jingle, of course.
You have to do that live every time. But...
it's odd that the jingle comes in halfway, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's that of the week feature. Maybe we could change the topic every time.
The dads. There's not much else we can that fits the podcast.
Deaths of the week.
Deaths of the week. Deaths
like an in memoriam.
It's topical. Has it got much humour to be mined, though?
Well, yeah, fair point.
From those who have imminently died. Imminently, that was.
Soon to be dead of the week.
Move up this one. Rich!
Yes.
Tell me, who is your dad of the week?
Well, we were recording this on the 12th of March, and so this news is not hugely topical, but it's the first episode back of the series, and it's someone who's... I guess passing has hit me very hard, and that is Jurgen Klopp. In many ways, my other father. For those who don't know, Jurgen Klopp is currently the manager of Liverpool Football Club. Liverpool Football Club is the team that I support. It's the team that Tom supports. It's one of the main reasons that we're friends.
Team my dad supported.
Team that your dad supported, and Jurgen Klopp is a real, an incredible sort of figure at Liverpool and in the footballing world. He's charismatic, he's funny, he just so happens to be probably one of the best managers of all time, who has brought incredible success to Liverpool with a very fatherly approach. He's known for really bringing through younger players, giving them confidence, building them up, putting his arm around them. He hugs all of his players. He's very sort of effusive. He's a very wise man when you see him in interviews. I mean, just on Sunday, Liverpool drew with Manchester City against all the odds. And it was an incredible game. And he was asked afterwards, are you going to miss this? And he said, yeah, of course I'm going to miss this. But for the last 30 years, I've missed out on everything else in life. And he talked about looking up and seeing his wife in the stands and all the things that, by being as committed as he has been to football and to winning and to success, he's missed out on other parts of life, and now he wants to go and experience that. And I just think that's such a rare thing in football, in sport, when they talk about sort of that elite winning mentality and success at all costs. It's very human. It was a very human sentiment, and I think he's a very human, and I will miss him greatly. when he leaves.
I'll miss him too. It's a travesty and a tragedy. And it's going to be worse when we see him managing Real Madrid in a couple of years.
Yeah, that will hurt. It's like,
imagine, that will hurt more.
Imagine if your dad didn't die, he just went off to manage a better child.
Do you ever wonder why I like Rich so much? It's because I was thinking of the same punchline.
Sorry, I got in there first. But Tom, who's your dad of the week?
So we've been watching a lot of Robot Wars.
Right, okay. As in the modern version of the old one.
You remember Robot Wars? No, but the old one from when it was good.
Yeah.
It opens up with Jeremy Clarkson as the presenter of Robot Wars in the first series. Forget that. Second series onwards, in comes Craig Charles.
Yes, much better.
For me, Craig has a lot of links to my dad anyway. They both got the Liverpool connection. My dad used to play his show on Six Music all the time. It's sort of the funk and soul music that Craig Charles used to play is exactly the music that my dad loved. He was a big fan of Northern Soul, and obviously Craig Charles as well, because that's what his show is. Yeah. And that's what he DJs a lot. So there's already a connection, which to me, whenever I see Craig Charles, does make me think of my dad. But let me tell you something. Craig Charles is present, and this is why the original Robot Wars works, is because Craig, and it's not because of the robots, though it helps. It's because Craig Charles is presenting the show like your dad would present Robot Wars.
Right.
He's talking to you, the viewer, the child, as doing a lot of laddie, matey jokes like you would at the pub, but they're not like you would at the pub because they're there for primetime BBC television, so they're completely toned down for a child to be okay with them. So all the jokes are really gentle puns, are really nice kind of gags your dad would do. They're all dad jokes.
Dad
really.
Jokes.
And I think that through the dad jokes of Robot Wars, Craig Charles, for me, has earned my title of Dad of the Week.
Well, congratulations, Craig. Congratulations,
so
Jürgen.
Well done, Craig.
Your trophies are being sent out to you. You will have to send them back before we record next week's episode. So
for
just
next week's
just to
people.
Sort of get them out, have a quick look, pop them back in the post if possible.
Yeah, just do your photos and all that stuff.
And if you've got any suggestions for a Dad of the Week that you want to send in, please do. They don't have to necessarily be topical. They don't have to be male. They don't have to be dads. Just anyone who you feel fulfills sort of the embodiment of what a father at its best should be.
And you don't even have to have a dead dad to take part in this one.
No.
If for some reason your dad's alive and you're listening.
If for some reason your dad's alive.
No. A, you can take care of that. But B, tell us who you've seen this week who sort of really brought up that dad for you. And really what we did there, the perfect example. Rich, someone topical, someone happening right now. Me, someone from the 90s. he's still around, but you know.
What I will say is if for some reason your dad is alive, absolutely email in, do listen to the podcast. Big fans of that, because he will die one day. We will make that
Literally.
Clear. But it would seem slightly braggy for you to email in and suggest your dad as Dad of the Week. That I feel would. That seems inappropriate, doesn't it? Is that stuff feels like showing off?
I think if you're going to, you're going to have a good case for it.
Yeah,
that's what I'm not ruling it out. I'm just saying you would have to put a good argument forward.
Yes, yeah,
for what he's done,
or perhaps he's on the way out, and then fair enough.
Yeah, then that's all right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not. Well, we don't want it to just become my dad's dying.
No, true.
That's a separate. That's a separate podcast.
Yeah.
But anything, just whoever you've got, let us know, and we'll probably get them involved on the later episodes. So, thank you so much for listening. If your dad is still alive, don't worry, because death, as it turns out, comes for us all,
but it comes for you first. See you next week.
You see.
Synchronized. See you next week at the end there as well.
That's
very good.
Professionals. Very professional.
Lovely.